Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins on the local news roundup. Signed, sealed, delivered. That's an adequate description of the state of the long-awaited North Carolina budget. In signing it, Governor Josh Stein had some good words about the budget when it comes to education.
This budget embraces ideas that work.
And he said it's a good start on fixing low teacher pay.
Today, we are beginning to right that wrong.
But he was critical of the portion of the budget devoted to the I-77 toll lanes.
It makes real the General Assembly's wrong-headed threats of retribution against Charlotte.
Meanwhile, Charlotte's new mayor meets the press. We'll share what he had to say, and mandatory parking minimums for new developments and what that may mean for the city. Here to fill us in on those stories and more is WFAE News reporter Nick Delacanal, who's also the local host of All Things Considered in the afternoons. Mary Ramsey is local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer, and Ben Thompson is with us. He's an anchor at WCNC-TV. This is WCNC-TV Week on Charlotte Talks. We had Brad Panovich here earlier this week. Good morning, everybody. Thanks for being here.
Good morning.
After months of negotiation, some foot dragging, a struggle between state House Republicans and Senate Republicans, we have a budget, a 634-page, $34 billion budget. Teachers, law enforcement officials, other state employees have been waiting and waiting for this so they could get their promised raises. And this bill enacts the largest teacher pay raise in at least 15 years. Nick, what do those teachers have to look forward to? Unmute yourself, Nick, or somebody turn his mic on.
Sorry about that. There we are. Okay. We know that these raises are going to be retroactive to this month, so they should show up in teachers' next paycheck. But actually, our reporter, James Farrell, our education reporter, did some great coverage looking at kind of breaking down these raises. So on average, there are 8% raises across the board. But if you get a little bit more granular, the biggest raises are actually going to starting teachers. So if you are, you know, fresh out of college, you're getting a job as a teacher in North Carolina, you're now going to start with $48,000 a year, which might not really sound like that much, but before this, starting pay was actually $41,000, and that's really not a lot. I'll give a disclaimer that this doesn't include, like, local salary supplements, but this is going to at least bring starting pay up to the national average.
So for starting teachers, that's about a 17% raise, and it's going to starting teachers, and there's a reason for that, and the reason was reiterated this week at a news conference that Governor Stein held when he signed the budget.
Beginning teachers are choosing to forego other more lucrative careers, and if they stay in North Carolina, they're missing out on better salaries that they could earn in our neighboring states. But today, we are beginning to right that wrong.
So, Ben, more experienced teachers in terms of years on the job and higher degrees as a result of going back to school while they're being in the classroom teaching younger students, they have been complaining for a long time about getting short shrift when it comes to raises. The raise is going to new teachers, but not to them. What will they be receiving, veteran teachers, in terms of raises?
It's going to be less than that, and even more so. And I think the ammunition that's going to give critics even more to talk about is that the raises plateau after 15 years. And I think after that, they get one more at year 25. So critics of this say this is really great for recruitment. It's going to bring in a lot of these teachers. It's not going to do a whole lot when it comes to retention and keeping those longtime veteran teachers that are so important to a school system.
So you got starting teachers having their pay raised from $41,000 to $48,000 a year, but the veteran teachers are getting a 5.5% raise, which increases their pay from $55,900 to $59,000, plus, as Nick pointed out, the local supplements that will increase that. Teacher compensation has been a particular problem for urban districts, Mary, like Charlotte, because of the increased cost of living here. And other urban districts like Wake County. Some CMS teachers can't afford to live here, and with the cost of living in North Carolina rising from 3.6 to 4% on average since the start of 2025, Some may not see this as much of a raise. What, if anything, have we heard about this from teachers?
Yeah, I think you guys have already hit on a lot of the notes from teachers, which is this is certainly better than nothing. More money is better than staying the same, especially given how late this budget came, how long educators have been waiting for these raises. That being said, it's not a perfect plan from the teacher's point of view. Ben really hit on the operative words, recruitment versus retention, younger teachers getting a bigger boost than older, more veteran teachers. So that's something that I think will be really interesting as we start to look forward to the next budget cycle. And you bring up a good point about those more urban school districts. Something we hear a lot in Charlotte is the fact that Mecklenburg is one of just a small handful of counties who don't get additional money from the state to help pay those supplemental salaries for teachers. That's left to Mecklenburg County, which puts some additional strain from the county's point of view on their budget.
And why is that? Why don't we get what the other areas of the state get? Do we know?
Yes. So it is, it's kind of exactly what you were just hitting on. It is a smaller group of counties that tend to be more urban, places like Mecklenburg and Wake counties. The logic from the legislators' point of view has traditionally been that those counties have a larger tax base, which means the counties are more able to pay a higher supplement themselves. But of course, the pushback from those urban counties is that any dollar they have to put into the teacher pay is money they can't put towards other services for the community.
Here's a question that nobody on this panel can answer. Since the justification for this is that we have a larger tax base in Mecklenburg County, that mostly comes from property taxes, and there's going to be, thanks to the General Assembly, a constitutional amendment on the ballot in November that would limit what counties can do in terms of increasing what they charge for property taxes. So as a result of that, should it pass, will the state take another look at their current policy with who gets what for schools?
That's a great question, maybe, but I also think that a lot of counties have expressed a lot of concern about that constitutional amendment, and especially smaller counties, I would say, even more so than the bigger ones.
Hmm. Yeah. So WFAE reported on Hannah Moon. She is a new Hanover County English teacher who was the 2005 Southeast Region Teacher of the Year. She said that the pay raise is welcomed, but that more progress is needed. And we also spoke to Laura Stewart, who happens to be a 22-year-old teacher at Shamrock Gardens Elementary here in Charlotte. She likes the starting teacher raises, as you would imagine, but would like to have seen bigger increases for veteran teachers to encourage teachers to stick around.
You also want these young teachers to be like, oh yes, this is my long-term career path. This is where someday I will make this amount of money. Someday, if I stick with this, I will become that veteran teacher that is, making good money.
Nick, which has been the bigger problem at CMS, attracting new teachers or keeping veteran experienced teachers? Do we know?
That's a good question. I would actually probably ask that to our education reporter, who might have a better idea, but it could be both. I think that attracting teachers and trying to retain them is that's kind of goes across all organizations. You want to bring in good employees and keep them here. I think both could be the challenge.
So at his budget signing ceremony, Governor Stein also noted that one of the major wins in this budget will be the students.
When it comes to student outcomes, this budget embraces ideas that work. Advanced teaching roles, science of reading expansion, school safety grants, apprenticeships, all ideas that I had included in my budget recommendation because they will improve student achievement.
So we did a whole hour with State House reporters earlier this week, and we never touched on this aspect of the budget. In fact, this is the first time I've heard of this. So do we have, Nick, any specifics on what the governor is talking about there?
And I'm sorry, can you say again what he was saying in that soundbite?
Well, we can play it again. Give them a chance in the control room to rack it up, and we'll play it back again.
When it comes to student outcomes, this budget embraces ideas that work. Advanced teaching roles, science of reading expansion, school safety grants, apprenticeships, all ideas that I had included in my budget recommendation because they will improve student achievement.
You know, Mike, I got to tell you, I'm actually not so familiar with this piece of the budget as well.
Okay. Yeah, we talked about it for an hour and that did not come up. At the budget signing, Governor Stein also noted that one of the major wins in this budget, well, I've already done that, haven't I? Let's talk about some other aspect of this budget. Teachers are not the only state employees set to receive raises. State employees are on the list with the State Bureau of Investigation and alcohol law enforcement personnel. They're earmarked to receive 16% raises. And civilian workers at the State Bureau of Investigation will get an average of 27.5%. Where will that put their salaries? Anybody know? Any of you know?
I don't know where I don't know where the final number is for where that ends up putting them. I think also notable in the list you just add, I would add one more to that. State troopers are going to end up with about a 13% raise, which as the governor points out, you take an on average, we'll say 3% raise for most state employees. When you're looking at 3%, I mean, that's especially considering how late this budget was. That is then, while nice, it is less than the cost of living adjustments that you take into account after several years.
But 27.5%, I don't think I've ever gotten a 27.5% raise. Maybe if I left one job and took another. That's probably the only
time. Me neither.
on the one hand, Governor Stein described the raises for correctional officer pay and state trooper pay as, quote, good, but still lagging that the kind of pay they get in other nearby states. And on the other hand, he had some good words of guarded praise about those raises.
The historic state trooper raises that we're excited about move starting pay from 49th to 41st in the country. If I told y'all we were 41st, you would not be proud, but it is a heck of a lot better than 49th.
Wow. We sound like Mississippi here. Stein wanted more of those officers, more for those officers and more for teachers. And he pointed out that state employees are only getting 3% raises, effectively receiving a pay cut, as Ben just pointed out, because of inflation. Now, this is the 2025 to 2027 budget that just passed and was just assigned. The raises are not retroactive, but there will be bonuses. Who will receive those? How much will they be, and do they make up for the fact in any way that the raises aren't retroactive? Mary, do you know?
I don't know the exact numbers off the top of my head, but I do know that the bonuses were another aspect of this budget that Governor Stein, as well as leaders in the legislature, were really touting as an accomplishment and trying to, again, similar to the discussion we were having about teachers, trying to address recruitment and retention in law enforcement, especially with other states in the region starting to outpace North Carolina in its pay and potentially then drawing employees away.
Ben,
I think on average the bonus is between $1,000 and $1,700 for the average state employee, and certainly not a lot. Certainly doesn't probably make up for the cost of living adjustment over a couple of years. But then, I mean, the other thing is you look at this, and the governor pointed this out and was upset about it. But you also have about 1,000 positions in state government that are not going to be filled or being laid off. So 3% is not much, and certainly not a bonus of $1,000. But when you then look at that, some of these positions are being eliminated entirely. It's not good news for those folks.
So when can teachers, law enforcement personnel, and others who are getting raises expect that to appear in their checks? How about 10 seconds?
Teachers should see their raises in their next paycheck. Okay. And I'm not sure about the state employees.
We're not done with the budget yet. There's still some things to talk about with regard to the budget, particularly the portion of the budget that calls for area municipalities who said no to the toll lanes to pay back the millions of dollars already spent on that project. We'll do that when we come back.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and United Way of Greater Charlotte, celebrating 95 years of impact in the Carolinas, strengthening nonprofits, neighborhoods, and people through the support of charitable contributions. More at UnitedWayGreaterCLT.org.
And Charlotte Talks on listener funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. Nick Della Canale is with us, host of All Things Considered at 4 o'clock this afternoon, doing triple duty today because he's also filling in for our senior editor. Mary Ramsey's with us, local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer, and Ben Thompson, an anchor with WCNC TV. So we're still talking about the state budget, which has passed and was signed into law by the governor earlier this week, and it calls for job cuts that you alluded to, Ben, a moment ago. I think 755 full-time jobs either being cut or simply not being filled, the vacant positions not being filled. Do we know what areas and how this might impact the ability of state government to perform what they're supposed to perform?
I think that some of those positions are vacant positions. I think that Ben had brought that up, but I actually think that that is one of the biggest questions. That's something I'm not entirely clear on, and it's something that I would like. I'm sure there are other reporters who are already looking into this, but that is actually a big question I have right now.
So this budget also calls for tax cuts, but those cuts have been slowed down. Senate leader Phil Berger wanted faster automatic cuts tied to the calendar. House Speaker Destin Hall wanted slower cuts based on economic triggers to make sure that the revenue streams to support those tax cuts were adequate. This apparently was a major sticking point throughout the budget negotiation process. So we had Phil Berger very strongly saying he wanted this tied to the calendar and Destin Hall saying the opposite. Is this a compromise between these two branches of government or two branches of the legislature? Or did Phil Berger just lose because he's a lame duck?
I don't think Phil Berger would probably describe it that way.
Of course not.
but I think astute observers could say that once you lose your primary and you're the most powerful politician in the state of North Carolina, that you lose some of we'll say your gusto. We were at an impasse up until this point, as you know. And as I always point out to people, I mean, this is an impasse among Republicans. This was not a Democrat-Republican thing. This was a Republican-Republican thing. And so, especially considering Destin Hall is fairly new in the job. He doesn't have the tenure that Phil Berger has in the Senate. So for him, he's walking away with what I would consider, and most people would consider, a pretty substantial wind at his back. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but also I do think that there have been instances in the past where things that Senator Berger wanted in the budget did not actually end up happening. I think it was a couple years ago he was trying to get money for a casino in his county. Yep. That kind of helped negotiations and ultimately didn't come to pass. So maybe there's a precedent.
Yeah. And that casino allegedly led to his defeat in the primaries. It was one of the factors that led to his defeat.
There was talk about that, right?
Interestingly, inserted into this budget bill, which is now law, was a provision put forward by Mecklenburg-Iredell State Senator Republican Vicki Sawyer that would make Charlotte and other members of the Charlotte Regional Transportation Planning Organization, who voted to kill the I-77 toll lane project, pay back the money already spent on it by the North Carolina Department of Transportation. Even when she introduced it, Vicki Sawyer, who is against toll roads in her own part of the county, even when she introduced it, she called this a punitive measure. She was honest about it, and that is precisely how Democratic Governor Josh Stein sees it.
It makes real the General Assembly's wrong-headed threats of retribution against Charlotte. Charlotte needs to enhance road safety and minimize community impact, and that balancing process should be collaborative.
Mary, why would Senator Sawyer be so honest about her intentions with this bill? Why does she want to penalize us for saying no when constituents said no to adding these toll lanes, especially when she does not advocate for them in the northern part of the county, which she represents? And why was this inserted into a state budget bill?
Yeah, in terms of insertion into the state budget, this was, you know, an amendment that was potentially going to be added to a separate transportation bill. Obviously, in the short session, with so much focus on the budget, things tend to sort of crystallize and come together quickly. You know, you just kind of tack things in where you can get something done. So I think it was probably more of a procedural maneuver in terms of getting it into the budget itself. But You know, I think you've hit on the crux of the conflict with this, which is that the leaders in Mecklenburg County who were upset about this, who do see it as punitive, really emphasizing that they were just executing the will of the community, given all of the pushback to these toll lanes when the plans came out and we saw the potential impacts to neighborhoods here in Charlotte. Whereas the state's point of view is more along the lines of, you know, we've already put $60 million into this project. There has to be some sort of consequence from their point of view, sort of dipping out midway into a process that the state had already put a significant chunk of change into.
Ben.
Yeah, I mean, this is honestly the state saying, hey, Charlotte, get your act together. This is not new. You guys have talked about this for more than a decade. Your city council has already approved the idea of it. Okay, now your constituents don't like it. But where was this several years ago? Why didn't you address this several years ago? None of this was new. So this is the consequence. We as a state, the DOT, has spent all this money designing this new interstate that now you've decided that you don't want. And we, the state, don't want to be on the hook for it.
But it wasn't just Charlotte City Council that said no. The CRTPO, which is the acronym.
Rolls off the tongue, right?
Rolls right
really
off
does.
The tongue. Anyway, they all said no. Every single one of them. We're talking about Davidson, Cornelius, Matthews, Mid Hill, Huntersville. They were in on this too, as was the city of Monroe initially. But then they've come back and said when they found out they might have to pay, they said, well, we will reverse our reversal. And we're back in on this now.
Ahead, okay, Ben. So I spoke to the mayor of Monroe, Robert Burns, about this a few days ago, and he describes it differently than how you just said it. He said that is basically a miscommunication between the mayor pro tem, who serves on CRTPO, and the rest of council, and that she was not voting for them. She was voting for herself, which was problematic. Cut to the chase, that he now says that had they known fully what was at stake, they wouldn't have done it. And he also told me, and this is the interesting, juicy part, is that he has spoken to other municipalities, he would not name them, who are now actively reconsidering their stance now that there is a lot of money on the line.
So Mary referenced $60 million that's already been spent. I've seen figures as high as $64 million. And the payback, I think, correct me if I'm wrong on this, would be based on the weighted value of the votes that these various municipalities have on the CRTPO. Charlotte would have the biggest heft because we have the most votes. Do we have any idea of what the monetary figures would be for any of these cities, towns?
It's a little complicated because, as Ben just alluded to, what made it into the budget also includes a sort of fix for municipalities who want to get out of this, which is that they have 90 days to change their mind again, to go back to supporting the toll lanes, and they won't have to pay. So potentially, if one or more of the municipalities that voted in favor of rescinding support for the toll lanes change their mind in that 90-day window, that would then alter the math of how this payback money to the state goes. Whether that actually happens remains to be seen. Mecklenburg County, who have been against this since the beginning, they voted against the toll lanes during the initial CRTPO vote back in 2024, seem pretty set in their POV. I asked new Charlotte Mayor Rob Harrington about whether we could see another Charlotte City Council vote in the 90-day window. He largely demurred, said the city is still reviewing what made it into the budget and what the implications are. So we'll have to see if anything actually comes of this. As you guys mentioned, Monroe already changed its mind, but some of that was more rooted in Monroe's rather interesting internal politics rather than the toll lanes itself.
I want to come back to Robert Harrington, our new mayor, in just a moment here. Ben, go ahead.
Yeah, the other gut punch in this is that if, for say, a city wants to go rogue and not pay, then their DOT projects get held up. And that's something else that the mayor of Monroe pointed out too. He said, we need that money and we need these projects and we're growing and we've got to get these things done. We can't, not only do we not want to pay our proportion of these $60 million, but we can't forego these DOT projects that we're relying on to get done.
Nick.
Yeah. And I'll just add too, that there has actually been some speculation though that Governor Stein, who is in charge of the Department of Transportation, he might actually be able to take some kind of action. And there might be a loophole in the law where he might actually be able to take Charlotte and the other municipalities off the hook. So that's something I know we're watching for. Steve Harrison has done some good reporting on that. Stein has kind of so far kind of put his hands up and said, you guys figure this out. I'm not really getting involved. But I think that there is going to be more pressure in the coming weeks to see if he's going to intervene or do something here.
There have been examples of other areas of the state rejecting projects that the NCDOT wanted to do and other organizations wanted to do after design and planning money had been spent, and they were not penalized. Why are we being targeted? Is this another instance of the great state of Mecklenburg being hit upon by the people in Raleigh?
I think you know the answer to that.
Okay. This is... It's also a way to force us into doing what they want, isn't it? I mean, if you don't want to pay big bucks, you'll do what
we say. Listen, Vicki Sawyer has actually said that she's just trying to be kind. Those are her words. I'm not sure exactly what that means. I think she's has had trouble explaining this, actually, but that's what she said.
So let's talk about the new mayor, because Mary, you just mentioned that you asked him some questions about I-77, and I know that Robert Harrington got together with reporters yesterday, and one of the things he touched on was how to handle this I-77 kerfuffle. He said that time is of the essence in terms of figuring it out. What else did he say?
Not a lot definitive. So as I mentioned, we're in this 90-day window where municipalities can change their minds and get out of paying this money unless, as Nick alluded to, Governor Stein steps in with a magic fix himself. And so this is one of the first major things on the new mayor's plate. And he did say time is of the essence, but other than that, basically just reiterated that the city is reviewing the text of the legislation that is now law, figuring out what they can and cannot do. I asked him directly if he thinks there's going to be another Charlotte City Council vote to try and get out of having to pay this money. He said that, again, they're still reviewing things and don't want to make any decisions before they have a better understanding of what exactly the implications of this text are. So nothing definitive.
We have a weak, I know that Nick wants to get in on this, but and I'll let you do that, Nick,
yeah.
But we have a weak mayor system here. Does the mayor have the power to say we're going to take another vote? Because the mayor doesn't even vote.
Not unless there's a tie. So if we were to get in a crazy situation where there was a tie,
can the mayor call for a vote? Can they put it on the agenda?
I mean, it depends on, there's the formal process and then there's the informal process. The mayor is always going to have some sway over what does or doesn't get discussed, even an interim mayor who just took office like this. Right. The Charlotte City Council really isn't doing much right now. They're on sort of their semi-official summer vacation. They don't really have any meetings on the books for a few weeks, so we'll see if any sort of special meetings pop up to discuss this or talk about it. But I mean, the mayor is always going to have some level of sway over what does or doesn't get a meeting.
Both Nick and Ben want to jump in here. Nick, you were first. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. You know, there's still some things that the mayor can do behind the scenes to try to get council members to do certain things. I was just going to add, he didn't say much to WFAE either in our interview with him, because I also asked him about this project. I asked him flat out, you know, the I-77 South toll lanes are a big issue. What do you think the city should do? His answer was, we need to engage urgently in a process that allows the community to engage. So I think that really does reflect his background as an attorney, being able to talk in gobbledygook, I guess, and not say much.
Ben.
Technically, yes. A mayor, despite very limited power, can put items on the agenda. That can happen. But then I'd say, then what? Because as Nick just alluded to, he says he wants to, you know, engage with the community. But for one, that's been happening for a couple of months now, and I think we've seen the result of that. And the other part of that is the time is ticking. We've got now less than a couple of months to address this. So if you're going to engage in the community in a meaningful way beyond what's already been done in the last few months and get some sort of different outcome, I'm not sure that's going to happen.
So, Nick, you did spend 15 minutes. I think every media outlet in the city.
Nine.
15 minutes. Nine minutes.
Oh, yes. And they
I
were...
think we got six.
We got like 13. So I guess the Observer.
Wow. Well.
There's about to be a fight.
The Observer.
Okay.
It's a contest and the Observer wins. Okay. But you spent your 9 minutes with Robert Harrington, our new mayor, yesterday, yeah. Nick. And one of the things he talked about was, in his mind, the importance of all voices being heard.
Yes. Excuse me. Yeah. So one of the questions we asked were just like, hey, you know, Charlotte's facing a lot of issues right now. What are your priorities? You're only going to be in office for 18 months. He didn't really get into specifics. He didn't name anything very specific, but he said that one of his big priorities was just making sure that all voices are heard, specifically on city council. He said he wants to preserve order and efficiency on the council. That's something he wants to do. And I think that it does kind of show he's coming in, maybe not with anything very specific that he's trying to do, but he's just trying to maybe keep the government running until the next election. That was sort of my sense.
And among the voices he thinks needs to be heard are those of the business community.
I think I know the business sector here in Charlotte pretty well. Understand what, you know, some of its priorities and needs are, but we've also been heavily involved in the community. I'm a very active member of my pretty large Baptist church. I've been heavily involved in the library and the arts and cultural scene.
And of course, on top of almost everybody's mind for the last year or so has been crime and the perception of crime. And you asked him a couple of questions about that, Nick.
Yes, that's right. We did ask, following the high profile stabbing on the light rail, you know, a lot of people still feel like they aren't safe in Uptown or in other parts of Charlotte, even as, you know, the police department's crime statistics have generally been trending in the right direction. But he did say that, hey, perception matters. This is something we do need to address. And he thought that sometimes there's a lag between, you know, crime statistics actually dropping and what people actually feel.
Public safety is a real concern for everybody. You know, you have to feel when you walk out of your door that you're safe, when you go to work that you're safe, when you're on the trains and the buses that you're safe. And visitors have to feel like, okay, I'm going to Charlotte because there's so much going on, but that I'm secure.
Another aspect of the conversation that some news outlets had with him was the Service Employees International Union pushing the city to do more to advocate for airport workers because there's a negotiation going on that the future of the American Airlines hub is at stake here. And he assured the reporters that that wasn't going anywhere, that we're just in the middle of discussions. But that's part of the discussions. Those folks in that union have been asking for higher wages and improved working conditions. And former Mayor Vi Lyles became a central figure in that because she had the power to break a tie on city council to study these wages and declined to do so. When we come back, perhaps we'll find out where Mayor Harrington stands on that and more. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. Nick Della Canale is with us, a local host of All Things Considered, and one of our reporters, Mary Ramsey's local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer, and Ben Thompson is an anchor at WCNC TV. So has the new mayor, Robert Harrington, said anything about where he stands on the aspect of Service Employees International pushing for better wages and living conditions, working conditions at the airport, something that the previous mayor, Vi Lyles, kind of put the kibosh on? Anybody?
Yeah, so this was something my Observer colleague Nick Sullivan asked new Mayor Harrington about, and somewhat similar to the 77 measure, kind of demurred. Mayor Harrington said he's not concerned about American Airlines just up and pulling out of Charlotte over this issue, but that it's something that will have to be sorted out as they work out this new contract. The sort of crux of the issue has always been these employees do not work for the airport or for the city. They work for a contractor who works for American Airlines, who work with the city to use space at the airport. So the question is, how much authority does the city have? Right. More progressive members of the city council, the SEIU, and some local advocates say that the way the city can exert some help for these folks is during these negotiations with American Airlines, sort of forcing American Airlines to pledge to work with companies that have good working conditions. Others in city leadership have said, basically, this isn't an area where we have authority. If we try and get in the weeds on this, it could tick off the state, which would could lead to penalties. They try and exercise more oversight over the airport themselves, as they've tried to do in the past. So sort of the baseline that Mayor Harrington is walking into, but another hot button issue that's going to be plopping right onto his plate in these first few weeks in office.
Let me stick with you for a while, Mary, because the Dominic Moody Safety Act became law this week. This is named after the six-year-old Charlotte girl who was found dead last December of alleged abuse, and it was abuse that was apparently overlooked on several occasions by local welfare officials. What does this new law do?
Yes, this new law creates what's called the Child Welfare Escalation Team. Basically, this is going to be a team of experts who will work out of the State Department of Health and Human Services, who county social services departments can call in when they're dealing with an exceptionally complicated or severe child abuse case. For example, a situation where the child has advanced medical needs, or with a family that has a history of abuse or child welfare issues. The idea trying to sort of have an extra catch for cases like Dominique Moody, where there have been a lot of questions about how she sort of fell through the cracks. The fact that there were police call outs to her home, questions raised to social services, but not a lot of action taken. The idea is that this new statewide team will come in, look through these severe cases, these complex cases, and make sure that what happened to Dominique Moody doesn't happen to other kids in North Carolina.
Perhaps I missed it, but in reading your story yesterday, to me at least, it was the first time I discovered or became aware of the fact that multiple Mecklenburg County employees were fired or disciplined after an internal investigation. What else can you tell us about that?
Yes, so that's something County Manager Mike Bryant revealed at the House Oversight hearing about Dominique Moody's case a few weeks ago. It's been a few weeks, so I don't want to get the exact numbers wrong, but if memory serves, I believe two employees of the county lost their job and multiple others were disciplined after an internal investigation that the county manager's office launched in the wake of Moody's death back in December.
And now also, actually, the head of the county's child welfare resigned as well shortly after, although she said that it wasn't, in regards to this case.
Right. Yeah. And that's separate from the numbers I mentioned before. And Kim Campbell is someone else. I got that name wrong. The former Child Family and Welfare Services who left that Nick just referenced said that it was for other reasons.
Yeah, other reasons. Right.
So as we have been talking about for several weeks now, without much explanation, the Charlotte-Mecklenburg School Board placed Superintendent Dr. Crystal Hill on paid leave last month. Yesterday, the Observer reported on what it found as a result of its own investigation through a public record search. You identified at least $1.7 million in contracts given to some of Hill's former colleagues. The school board has refused to comment on what you discovered and on whether or not this is what they're looking into. But what can you tell us about what you found out about these contracts?
Yes, so my colleague Rebecca Noel looked into this following some excellent reporting from our news partners at WSOC about these contracts and whether they are potentially tied to the investigation of Superintendent Hill that led to her suspension. As you said, the board has not confirmed that, but we did find through public records inquests almost $2 million in contracts given by CMS during Hill's tenure to companies tied to her former colleagues from when she was an executive within the Cabarrus County School District.
Okay, more to come on that, I'm sure, in the coming weeks. Atrium Health has agreed to a $1.8 million, that's a lot of 1.8s going around today, a $1.8 million settlement in a class action lawsuit over claims that it shared patient data for targeted ads. Nick, who was affected by this?
Anyone who had a My Atrium Health or My Carolina's Patient Portal account between 2015 and April 2024, if you did, you may be eligible for compensation.
I'm rich. because I did. Atrium put a pixel evidently on there. This is technical, but they put a pixel, which is a little tiny dot, on their website and on their patient portal, so that when you got there, it allowed patient data to be collected by Facebook, our favorite company, and Google, our second favorite company, which then used it for targeting advertising to you. Was it just the fact that the pixel allowed ads to be fed to you on those platforms, or did those platforms get more personal data about you, health information, for instance?
Well, yeah, that's what plaintiffs argued. They said that this allowed personal health information to be shared with Meta and Google without patients' knowledge. So that was the allegation.
Wow. Atrium has denied any wrongdoing, but they settled nonetheless. So how do people know if they've been affected? How do they apply for some of the settlement money if they think they've been affected? And how much will I get, Nick?
I'm not
That's
sure.
That's really all I care about.
I'm not sure on the exact amount. I think it does depend on how many people file claims. But again, if you had, you know, a portal, and if you used it between, 2015 and April 2024, mm-hmm. You can file a claim by September 28th. The judge is going to consider the final approval of the settlement on September 30th.
It's been really hot globally. It's been really hot here. Some areas have had drenching rains. Some have had severe flooding. We have gotten the heat, but not much of the rain. We got some rain on Monday night. And during that big storm on Monday night, which did not put a dent in the drought, there was property damage, particularly at Roof Above. That's the organization that takes care of the homeless. Part of its roof in a place in their building called The Hub, where they serve meals and do other services, like showers and laundry for the homeless. The roof caved in. How bad is the damage?
Well, our reporter Clara Otati described it as almost apocalyptic when you walk in. And I think that's right. If you look at the photos, it's very dramatic. There is a huge hole in the ceiling of the room where they serve lunch to people who are homeless in Uptown. She described, chairs and tables overturned. The floor was caked in mud. There was flood water in the building. I know this building also provides shower services and laundry services. And one of the people who works there said that, they're still trying to figure out the scope of the damage and whether the building can even be saved. Wow. And, it does seem like if it can be, it will be a very expensive repair that could take months.
Jeremy Hall is Roof Above's chief philanthropy officer.
Well, this is a huge impact to our business and our business model. We've tried to navigate some of our programs to an adjacent building, which is an old train station. But there are a couple of things we're going to have to look to external partners. And so we're looking for community support to help fund a lot of those projects.
Although he mentioned their business and their business model, they are not a business. They are a nonprofit. And he says their future is now unclear because they don't know if repairs are possible or even how long they may take.
The hope is that we can find a way of restoring it and restoring our services.
He made those comments earlier this week, and yesterday he sent out an email to the media that says, among other things, all we can say with certainty is that we will be operating without the Hub for at least 6 months, probably longer, and it will be a $5 to $10 million effort to repair and renovate. So they're looking for money for that project. Meanwhile, WFAE climate reporter Zachary Turner reported this week that in Charlotte, summer overnight temperatures have risen by nearly 2 degrees in the last few years. This is a global phenomenon. This is happening everywhere. And evidently, if you don't have air conditioning and you cannot cool off at night, you don't cool off. Ashley Ward is the director of Duke University's Heat Policy Innovation Hub, and she says warmer nights pose dangers to residents who don't have access to or cannot afford air conditioning.
You can't rely on being able to open up your windows and take advantage of the breeze to cool down your body and your house.
And Lauren Cini, a medical director at Duke University's Emergency Department, points out that hot days followed by warm nights can chip away at your ability to self-regulate.
In medicine, we kind of talk about it's like you're a marathon runner and you're running multiple races, multiple days in a row without letting time for recovery in between.
So this is a long time trend from which there are no signs that we're going to turn the corner on it, but we will turn the corner locally on it this week because weather and climate are separate. And this weekend, we're expecting a cold front to move in with daytime temperatures in the mid 90s with heat indices about 100 or so going away, and we'll be in the mid-80s next week with lower humidity and in, maybe in the upper 60s at night. Wow. Ben, North Carolina has had mandatory parking minimums for most new developments. That means shopping centers, apartment complexes, until now. Governor Josh Stein just signed a bill that eliminates those requirements. What kind of developments will that impact, and why did lawmakers do this?
Okay, so this is the least sexy story.
That's why we gave it to you.
Thanks, I appreciate that. But one that really matters to cities and towns, and you hear urbanists talk about it all the time. And think of it this way. If you think about like Charlotte in Uptown or South End, anytime you see a relatively empty parking garage, that is a result of a parking minimum. So what state lawmakers have decided, and the strange thing is these are strange bedfellows you see. You have Democrats, you've got some conservatives. The city of Raleigh passed this on their own years ago. So what you have is people saying, hey, developers, we're not going to require you to have a certain number of parking spaces for your apartment complexes or your shopping centers or things like that. Now, you're incentivized to create as many as you need for your own business, but you're not going to be forced to pay, say, $30,000 for a parking spot in a garage, which is what garages cost. And therefore, the thinking is, then that money's not passed along to all the consumers, making everything a lot more expensive.
Mm-hmm. So Statesville Councilman at Large, Trey Robertson, told WCNC-TV how business has stalled in Statesville due to these parking zoning laws.
I know definitively that we had about 7 or 8 businesses or construction projects that got shelved because our zoning ordinance required more parking than was feasible on the spot.
Okay, that may be the case in Statesville, but this sounds like a local issue that should be controlled by local municipalities. Charlotte is not Statesville and vice versa, so why is the state making a blanket decision about this?
I think, again, you have different warring factions from different sides of the aisle that are coming to agreement on this, and I think Charlotte, surprisingly, as transit-centric as we have tried to be, we've not passed this on our own. So you can talk about the blue line and the red line and the silver line and the gold line and all of them in between. But this is actually a piece of legislation that will complement that because it's saying, hey, we don't have to have necessarily all these parking spaces when we have transit options as well.
So evidently, we also have a shortage of people available to inspect local nursing homes and assisted living communities. And the Mecklenburg County Commission, Mary, put out a plea. What are they asking?
Yes, they are asking for volunteers to join a pair of advisory boards that go out into these nursing home and assisted living facilities to perform regular inspections and check-ins for residents. These boards are supposed to have, I believe, the nursing home board around 35 members, the assisted living board more than 40. Both are in the single digits right now, so they have a lot of open spaces.
And the commission has called the lack of these volunteers unacceptable. Well, if it's unacceptable, why don't we have Mecklenburg County employees that take care of this?
So I'm not fully versed in all of the different oversight apparatuses that oversee these facilities. So I'm not sure exactly. I would imagine that the county health department also has some sort of role in this. But basically, these advisory boards are supposed to really sort of act as a conduit between the facilities and the county, alerting them when they see issues, building relationships with residents, things like that.
As we all know, the excitement was palpable earlier this week when it appeared as though the U.S. soccer team would beat Belgium in the World Cup. Instead, after Donald Trump made a call to the head of FIFA and subsequently a red card on a U.S. player was removed, allowing him to play, they lost 4-1. Charlotte FC's Tim Ream was the captain of the U.S. men's national team. And despite their loss, he says he hopes the team inspired more people to get excited about soccer in America.
If you look at what we've done, I don't think the conversation should die down. I think it should be how incredible this journey has been with this group. You know, how can we keep the conversation going? How can those boys and girls continue to inspire them now that the tournament is over?
So rest assured, soccer fever will continue in Charlotte because Charlotte FC is hot, and Charlotte will soon host the first MLS, its first MLS All-Star game later this month at Bank of America Stadium. How did we snag this? What will the economic impact be? Very quickly, Nick.
Well, I'm not sure what the economic impact will be, but I know it's coming up July 29th. It's going to be a Wednesday night, and I think it does kind of add to the city's reputation as a soccer destination.
It does, but Atlanta is just down the road. They have a better stadium, a newer stadium, and cheaper concessions, so it's a puzzlement. Nick Della Canal is the host of All Things Considered here on WFAE. Ben Thompson is an anchor at WCNC-TV. And Mary Ramsey is local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Thank you all very much for the hour.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. Our intern is Emmy Berger. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to visit past episodes, or to sign up for the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.